Hey, lovelies. I am currently on a pop-up tour. You can come shop in person and hang out with me on a six-city tour that I'm in the middle of doing right now as this episode is being released. So yesterday, I was in Brooklyn. Today, Monday 4/8, I'm in the Five Towns hosted by J'Apparel from 10:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. and then again from 7 to 9 p.m. On Tuesday 4/9, I am in Baltimore hosted by the Mimi Boutique from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and then 8 to 10 p.m. On Wednesday 4/10, I am in Lakewood, hosted by Sorority, and I'll be there from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and 8 to 10 p.m. On Thursday 4/11, I am in Muncie, hosted by Beautiful Boutique from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and then 8 to 10 p.m. And on Sunday 4/14, I am flying out to Chicago, hosted by Magenta. I'll be there from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and then 7:30 to 10 p.m. I hope to see you in person. I cannot wait to shop with and style you all. And of course, ImpactFashionNYC.com is always open, and you can shop my modest styles that are available in sizes 2 through 28 by going there. Enjoy the show. From Impact Fashion, it's Be Impactful, a show about the women making a difference in their own corners of the world. And on today's show, I sit down with three women whose husbands are currently serving in the IDF. They share what the first days of the war were like, the mental health aspect of having a husband at war, what it's like to reintegrate a husband temporarily into a family that functions totally differently, and some misconceptions. I am in absolute awe of Yaffe Newman, Tali Wogelenter, and my third anonymous guest today. As an American living in New York, I've had some unique experiences since the outbreak of the ongoing Israel-Hamas war, but the whole time I've been wondering what it's like over there, specifically for women whose husbands picked themselves up and went right into the battlefield.
Hello, everybody. This is a very special episode, and I am very excited to dive in with all of you wonderful Israeli army wives. And this episode is going to be a little bit different from other episodes that I do. Just first of all, there's three of you and one of me, so I'm only a little bit intimidated, but that's besides the point. Aside from just the, like, I am in awe. I am in absolute awe of what you three have been through over the last little bit. So what I'd like to do now is let's go through everyone. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Tell me what your life was like kind of pre-war, what your husband does in the war. Let's just get everyone, a little bit acquainted. And Yaffe, I'd like to start with you.
Hi, Rifki. Thanks for having me back again, I should say. It's our honor, at least my honor and pleasure to be here. So thank you for doing this. I think it's important to shed a light on this, and I really appreciate it. Pre-October 7th, my husband is a third-year computer science student. This was supposed to be the last year of his degree, and he will start simultaneously also doing smicha. And I was the imbaid of a well-known seminary in Jerusalem, and we were just about to transition into a new job, a new stage of our lives. And we were about to leave Yerushalayim and move to Yivat Shmuel to work for JLIC and Bar Ilan. And that date was set to be days after the 7th. And when the 7th happened, he was called to Miluim. In his active duty, he was part of a special forces unit in Gibati. And he also is a katzin, which is an officer. So in Miluim, he also is a katzin, and he had a bunch of soldiers under him. And he was in Gaza for like the last two months, I guess.
Is he home now? Because I know like a lot of the Miluim guys are coming home. Miluim, we should say, is reserves. And my understanding, I should say this for everyone, we said this before we started recording, my role here is to be the dumb American asking really dumb questions, because I fully don't understand how this works, aside from just that, like, there are people fighting. My understanding is that Miluim, which is the reserves, are just people who, like, at any point the army can be like, yo, we need you now. And that's exactly what happened after October 7th. And then they went and they fought, but it's only for 3 months. So, like, they're starting to come home now. Is that, like, some of them are talking? What does that mean?
I don't think that there's a time limit on how much you could be called for milui. Maybe there legally is, and I just don't know. To my understanding, I think it's pretty like indefinite, especially in times of war. Miluim also just reserve duty looks very different, just as like a, if we're saying this is for like, you know, people who might have no idea, it looks very different for different people depending on if you were special forces, combat assistance, if you were what Israelis call drobnikim, which is non-combat positions, if you were in a rabbinical position. Like there's the army, I think people oftentimes forget, is like a huge machine, and like this isn't like a pitying thing to say, like I've seen it up close and personal. Like you need literally every single position, every single person. Like people oftentimes forget that like there's more than just combat soldiers and more than just like fancy intelligence people. There's a lot of other people who are doing equally important and sometimes secretive, sometimes not secretive jobs that are like very vital. So all of those different things will affect what your miluim look like in normal times and also in war times. And then the second thing that affects that is your rank. So regardless of whether you're combat assistance or non-combat, there are different ranks that you could have, and the ranking that you have could affect A, how much miluim time you have, and B, how active you are in miluim. Like for example, because Nadav is a katin, so his soldiers have a rotation that he has to make with one of his soldiers every time before they go back into Gaza, and like he's not on that rotation because like he's the officer, so like he can't leave. Like he only gets to leave when everybody leaves. So it's really dependent. But I don't think that there's a time limit on miluim.
Okay, so there we go. First dumb thing that Rifki has said, and we're not even 5 minutes in. This is good. This is fantastic. Well, I say dumb jokingly, but I think that, you know, the reason why I wanted to have this discussion, and first of all, I should just say thank you to Yafi, who, you know, you and I have known each other for quite some time, and you assembled this panel for me, which I really appreciate, is that there's, like you said, there's the day-to-day of it that we just don't really understand, you know, what's going on. Tali, tell me a little bit about, you know, how you're, you know, what's been going on in your life since and what your husband does.
Yeah, so my husband and I are the directors of the JLIC here in Kibbutz Shmuel and Bar Ilan, and my husband serves as the rabbi of the Anglo community in Kibbutz Shmuel. When the war broke out, my husband actually had what's called a ptor from Miluim, which means he had an exemption from doing Miluim. He did the army as a lone soldier when he was in yeshiva about 16 years ago. So because he was released with an exemption, he was not called into Miluim. As soon as the war broke out, we looked at each other and we said, what was the point of him serving, you know, and training all those years ago, if not to now be part of defending our country? And so not only did he join the army, he had to actually push for an exemption to his exemption.
That's the most Jewish thing ever.
Yes, exactly. So he spent like the first 2 weeks of the war using every connection that he had to try to find his way in, to try to get into a unit that he could best be supportive in. He was trained in combat. So he went in originally as a rabbi in a combat unit, but then was transferred into a unit that is a very undesirable unit to be in because of the work that they do. And without getting into too much detail, it's essentially the Zaka of the army. Zaka is the organization which deals with death, dead bodies, and anything related to that for civilians. And so there's a unit in the army for that purpose as well. If God forbid there's a fallen soldier or a civilian killed during the war effort, that his unit deals with anything related to that. And so because of his training in combat and then also his training as a rabbi, he was a good fit for that unit. And that's where he ended up throughout the war.
What has that been like? Well, first of all, I should just say, because we know, because I just learned there are different lengths of time. Is he still in the war? Is he home now? Where is he right now?
So I'll tell you kind of the baseline feeling, I think, of most Miluim wives. It's kind of that same feeling as the end of a pregnancy where people ask you, you're still pregnant? Mm-hmm. You didn't have the baby yet? And your husband's not home yet? He's still in the army? Is the same question. And even once your husband comes home, there isn't really a feeling of relief or them being home, because this war is ongoing and because there's so much uncertainty to the war. I think even those who are released, it's on a kind of conditional basis of you're released for now until we need you again. So personally, my husband was unreachable for several days in the last, or several, for about a week in the last week. And then just yesterday, he appeared at the door and claims he's home now for a while. To be determined.
So when you say that he just showed up at your door, you're saying that like you hadn't spoken to him for a week and then there was a knock on the door and it was him.
I hadn't spoken to him for a week. I got a message from his commander's wife saying that they were on their way out of Gaza. Within the hour, I got a call from him saying that they were debriefing, they were taking down the base, and they were heading home. Literally from 1 hour to the next, he was in Gaza, then he was out of Gaza, and then 24 hours later, he was home.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. The third wonderful member of our panel would like to stay anonymous, and that is totally fine. And I believe that the reason is because you said that your husband's family actually doesn't know what he does in the army.
Correct. Yeah. Actually, my husband has a very similar job to what Tali was just describing, which is basically they are Zaka of the army. But he had his position kind of known for about 4 or 5 years before. So when he originally served in Netzach Yehuda, which is basically the Dati version of there's a bunch of like these types of units, but it was like one of the units that he went in. He served for about 2 2.5 years as a lone soldier. And about 5 years ago, he was told, like, once you leave these units, they give you different positions in Miluim. So you're either a combat soldier or you're going doing a month of Miluim every year. My husband had this kind of a tafkid, which is, how do I even translate
Tafkid is a
tafkid?
job.
His job, right? So he knew that this was going to be his job, that he goes in, and during times of war, he has to be there, like he's there from the beginning to the end. But his Miluim service every year was just a couple days. They do their missions that they need to do, and that was basically it. So once the war broke out on October 7th, at like 10:30 a.m. that Shabbat morning, like my husband was already south, and they were basically helping out with fallen soldiers, fallen civilians that were around the Gaza Strip. And that was so my husband's family doesn't know about it. A lot of his friends don't know about it. And yeah, that's why we kind of want to stay anonymous for now.
That's totally fine. Can you talk me through the decision to not for like for your husband's family to not know what he does? What was there a particular reason why you or your husband just didn't want them? Like, do they just think that he's like a regular soldier? Like, what was the thought process there? Why was that important to you?
So I think that the main reason is that we don't want his parents to worry about it. My sister-in-law actually found out. We were during the war, like we had a day where I could go and see him, and she's like, let's go. And me and her just started sitting down and talking about it. And she's like, you know, I heard this inspirational guy, his name is Arki, and he's sending out all these amazing videos. And I was like, oh my God, me and my husband, like my husband's with him. And she's like, wait, what? And we all know what Arki does, and we all know where he's at. So my husband and him were together in the army and during Miluim. And basically the thought process is just like, a lot of times when my husband's out of the army, when he came home for a day or two or a week or whatever it was, people would ask him like, oh, what was it like? What was this? And he's like, I don't want my family to know what I do. I don't want them to ask me these questions. It's more for other people that I have to talk about it. It's not for me.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that last line?
So a lot of times, I'm sure this happens also with every single soldier out there. It doesn't matter if they're in the north or in the south, or if they're like Yafi said in logistics or Jobnikim, whatever it is. Everyone asks this question of like, did you go into Gaza? How long were you there? What were you doing? And a lot of these things, like I know personally for my husband, when he talks about it, it's more for the person that's asking, like, oh, you need to know something about what I went through. Instead of it being like, hey, how are you doing? How are you here right now? How are you able to be with your family and with your kids? How is it being let out for 24 hours and take getting out of that army mindset and where you're at? But the questions are always like, oh, what did you do? What did you see? How many people did you interact with? Where are you guys at? Where in Gaza are you? So that's basically why we want to stay like anonymous. A lot of people still don't know what he does, and when he comes home, it's like, you know, the basic, you know, it's hard, but we're taking it day by day.
So it's to kind of avoid like the voyeuristic, just people who are like, what's it called? Like tragedy porn that are just like so fixated on the horrors of what's happening and just want to get up all those details when it's doesn't really serve his well-being.
Exactly. At one point, he was home for about a week. He was let out for a week, and it was one of the longest times he was home. And he went to go see his friends from work, and he opened up to them about what he saw. And people, like, the second you also say, oh, I'm in Zaka, or this is what I do, the room just gets quiet. You know, nobody really wants to talk about it. Everyone has seen the videos. Everyone knows what's going on. And it's just like, it's difficult to talk about. You don't, the second you also hear about what's going on, you don't really want to hear about it. You don't really, this is not the fun side of the army that you kind of want to hear.
Right. Yeah. I mean, is there a fun side to the army? I guess so. I
Right.
mean, like there are the people, like I guess the like Yaffe said, there are people who are not in like direct combat positions and it's a much less intense situation. I actually have a nephew who's an engineer and he's like at a desk job, which is super important, but it's a very I'm not stressed about him specifically when we hear that like a soldier has fallen. Like that's I'm not like I know it's not him. Or it would be highly unlikely for it, you know, to have been him. And it's a very different kind of experience. The thing that I keep thinking of is, and that I've heard a lot actually, is as people are kind of telling these stories, and especially with soldiers that are in more intense positions, is the mental health aspect of this all. And your experience being home and essentially a single mom's for the time that they are away is hard and is difficult and is as stressful as stressful can be with everything going on. Has there been any way that you have been able to kind of be mindful of your own mental health, your husband's mental health, if you know, when they come home for short periods of time? What has managing that aspect of all of this been like for you, Yaffe? I'll start with you.
I feel like no.
That's a fine answer.
I want to like have like a pretty answer for you and be like, yeah, this, that, but like in all honesty, no. Like I feel like myself and most people who I know, especially those whose husbands are involved, like all three women right now who are here, like directly involved with like the really, really particularly horrific side of what's happening right now, like there's not, and it's not only them, of course, like, but specifically people who have firsthand been involved. I feel like we're all in survival mode, you know? Like I've had really well-meaning people, like friends who are like very far removed, oftentimes by distance, sometimes not necessarily less connections to what's happening, et cetera. I'd be like, oh, you need to take care of yourself, like don't read things, don't talk to people about things, et cetera. Like if it's like things that are hard, like you know, like without being away, the army, what he's potentially dealing with, et cetera. And I'm like, that's really lovely. And that's maybe nice in theory, but like this isn't like a video game or some like horror movie that I'm watching and then I can press pause. Like I've stopped counting the number of people who like are Nadav's friends who are dead. Like I've stopped thinking about the number of people he knows who are no longer alive. And that's just like, that's not even the things that he's seen directly. That's like the things that have happened to him. Like there's no like there's like coping mechanisms, I guess you could say, that like we're using. But and those really have differed from speaking to friends who are also in similar positions. Those have really differed from like couple to couple, family to family, person to person. But at the end of the day, like I think pretty much all of us are currently still in survival mode. And even the people who I know who have started therapy as a result of everything that's happened recently, not people who, like, you know, were seeing their therapists, like, they're only scratching the surface, like, which I'm not saying that we shouldn't be going to therapy. I think we all should be going to therapy. Nadav and I's running joke right now is that, like, we keep saying, like, when this is all over, like, you have to go to therapy, like, meaning him. Like, I love therapy. I'll stay in therapy no matter what's happening in my life. But yeah, I think, like, as at least for myself, for us, like, we're in survival mode, you know? Like, if he wants to talk about things, like, I personally feel okay talking about it. I have other friends who they are not okay talking about what their husband's doing. They don't want to hear it. And their husband needs to find another outlet. I have other friends who they want to talk about it, but their husband doesn't want to talk about it. Like, I feel like every family unit is really dealing with this very differently, depending on, like, whatever their cup can hold.
I hear that. Tali, you have been nodding the whole time Yafi's speaking.
Yeah, the concept of survival mode, I think, is a really critical point to understand right now, both for those who are in this, like, directly impacted by the war, and those of our brothers and sisters in America or outside of Israel who are feeling it, but not in it. When you're in survival mode, you do what you need to do to get by. And I think that a lot of times in life, we talk about the concept of, like, God only giving us what we can handle, or we get the strength to handle what we're given. And you only know that sometimes in retrospect. None of us sitting here asked to be strong. No one who's sitting here asked to prove that we can be on the home front and handle our kids and handle our families and handle our communities and whatever else that we're in charge of while our husbands are on the front lines. And if you were to ask me on October 6th, hey, Tali, do you think you could run your home for 4 months and run your community for 4 months while your husband's on the front lines? I would say absolutely not. I don't have that in me. But when you're put in a situation without a choice, we have a built-in sense of resilience that we don't have a choice but to tap into. And I don't know if I speak for the other women sitting here, but the concept of being called heroes or being called strong, that's beautiful. But realistically, I don't want to be a hero. I don't want to be strong. And so living in survival mode is not a choice. It's a fact. And I think that piece of mental health really right now is almost a silly concept, because we don't have time to reflect or have time to deal with our emotions. We're in our emotions now. I think we will need to reflect and look back and say, wow, I was a different person during that war, and I had strength and I had resilience that I didn't know I needed and I didn't want to need. And I don't want to ever need it again. So I think there's a lot of talk about mental health, and I think that, thank God, there's a lot of awareness of it, both from outsiders and even within Israel. The government has offered stipends for soldiers and their families to get therapy subsequent to the war, but I don't know that any of us are even ready for that.
Are you planning on eventually using that stipend?
Well, first and foremost, when my husband was placed in his unit, I said to him, if you go to this unit, you have to promise me that you will see a therapist afterwards. So yes, we will definitely use it. As Yafi said, we're very pro-therapy in our house. So we will continue to see our therapists as we go through the war. I think men and women approach it differently, at least based on the conversation going on here tonight. And so, yes, I will definitely encourage my husband to find ways that works for him. I think therapy looks different for different people. I will say, though, that the Army, up until this point, seems to be doing a very good job of debriefing after each mission and providing what's called Chosen, which is like emotional psychotrauma support after each mission, where they kind of also like a form of debriefing, but psychological debriefing, not strategic debriefing, to prevent, hopefully to prevent further trauma from developing.
Are you Are all three of you really concerned about things like PTSD and just long-term effects on your husbands?
I am.
At first, I was very, very worried. Also, my husband's the type of person that doesn't talk about anything, and like everything was very much bottled up. But I think the first time that he came home and we really just sat, we sat with each other and we looked at each other, and I was like, "Are you okay?" And he's like, "Honestly, I'm fine." And I think the fact, Tali, I don't know how it would be different for you because your husband kind of went in not really knowing about his job, but my husband had years of preparing and knowing, like, hey, my job is bringing home soldiers and bringing peace to families. And if this is my job, if this is what I was given as my miluim, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it to the highest degree. I don't think anybody was ready. No, every single Jew out there still has PTSD from everything that went on October 7th and thereafter. But thank God, like, my husband has a very, very strong head. And like, if anything, I have more PTSD knowing what he's gone through and everything he's been through than he does. Because when I spoke to him about it, to him, it's like, listen, I do this with 30, 40, 60 other guys. Like Tali said, they have incredible therapists and psychologists that are with them throughout every mission. So there is that support. It's more like for the long run of like them coming home, and when they're home, how is that going to be? I'm not so worried about him, thank God, but like every other soldier, I think for sure. Everyone, yeah.
You're nodding again, Tali. I like that you're a nodder. It makes my job easy.
I was just going to say, I think that while the soldiers, there's always a concern for PTSD. And I think even the soldiers who share and are open and seem the strongest, we never know. You never know how someone's going to digest something. I think the broader piece that I'm concerned about is not necessarily his personal PTSD, because there's so much awareness of that and so much focus on that that we're kind of like ready to tackle that. It's more the almost the PTSD as a family structure of not just my personal family, but as a country. Our husbands left, or our fathers left, or our brothers left, or our sisters, or whoever. We learned how to function without them. We put up these defense mechanisms, and then they come home as different people. We are functioning as different people with our defenses up, because we had to put our defenses up to protect ourselves. I was in constant fight or flight mode from the moment Steve walked out of the door on that first day, because I was now the entire parent body in my house. And to learn how to navigate again and to put those defenses down and let someone else back in. Even though we were a two-parent house a lot longer than we were a one-parent house, the intensity was so much greater that the amount of time doesn't really matter. And so I think that's a piece of what I would call PTSD that we're all going to have to learn how to navigate to refunction as a country with more functioning people, because more than half the country was on the front lines, whether north or south, at a desk or in combat. We were functioning as half a country. We still are. And so I think learning how to reintegrate as what I would call a normal society, that's something we're going to have to learn.
Yeah, I can see how that would you like you said, you develop these systems to function under these abnormal situations, and then it's not like you can just rewind the clock and go back to October 6th. Everyone is different. Everything about everything is different. And figuring that out is that's a hell and a half right there. Yaffe, what is that bringing up for you?
I agree with everything that Tali said. I think that a lot of it is like the families, like I see my child, like a lot of our friends' kids, the things that they've gone through, how it's affected them, how they relate to us, themselves, the world around them, like their fathers who are missing, And I think the family units, all of us, like Tali said, as a country, as a nation, like really are gonna have to unlearn certain things and relearn new things to be able to cope in like the new reality that we live in today. Because things aren't back to normal. Like on one of the times that Nadav came home from Gaza, I heard him on this on the phone with one of his soldiers, and they were like joking, and like he was like, oh, he's like, it's not so perfect when you come home, huh? And like it's like also for the soldiers, like even if they want everything to be amazing, even if they want everything to be perfect, even if we do, like it's hard, like it's really hard. Like a lot of times people are like, oh wow, like your husband's home must be perfect, and like no, it's not perfect. Sometimes I screamed at the top of my lungs and like, you know, wanted to cry afterwards that night. That like, oh my God, my friend's like cousin was just murdered, and here I am screaming at my husband who's like, you know, still alive. Like, how could I? And like, it's hard. It's really hard. And I remember I opened up to like a few friends about that, and they were like, oh my God, me too. And Baruch Hashem, like really, like people have really rallied here in Israel, and like everyone's trying to help everyone out. And there was like a support group that was run by psychologists in our community. And at the support group, someone else brought like this exact thing up that like when your husband comes home, like it just isn't this like easy thing to fall back into. And that like the guilt of like, but what if you get in a fight? And what if it was something stupid that you fought over? Or what if it wasn't something stupid that you fought over? But like, how could you possibly get into an argument with your husband who's still living and breathing in front of you when, like, you know, somebody who you know's husband, brother, or son, like, was just murdered? Like, so it's a really hard thing to grapple with.
Also,
It's really
like, what
hard.
if you get in a fight about something dumb and then he gets called back to the army tomorrow? And then you're the whole time while he's in the army, you're just like, oh my God, if he dies right now, then we fought about like his socks on the floor or whatever, something, you know, equally tragic. And that must be, I can imagine that being really all consuming in your head.
No, mamash, it's super all consuming. And also, like, as a general, like, I think there's like a big misconception of like, oh, he's home, like, it's fun time, but like, he's home, and now it's time to deal with like our taxes, and it's time to deal with like our like child vomiting. And like, one of the times that Adop came home, like, our child vomited like literally everywhere, and like, I was vomiting. Like, it's not this like romantic, exciting, like, you know, thing that happens. It's difficult and it's hard, and we're so thankful when they come home because we know that they very likely could not come home, but coming home now looks different than what that used to mean before October 7th.
Do you find that there are any other like misconceptions about this whole army wife experience that you've come up against these past 4 months?
Misconceptions. I mean, like the whole idea, I think somebody mentioned this before about like, oh, like you're a hero and everything. I think this is what you're asking, but like it is beyond incredibly hard to be a single mom, but it's not even the single mom part. It's just the you're worrying about your husband, whether you're in contact with him or not, whatever they're doing there. It's just like it's I don't think there are any misconceptions. I think everyone has it like on the point. It's so hard. You're a mess. Everyone's a mess. Your house is a mess. And you still have to go to work, or you still have to study, or you still have to show up to your community and be there for them. It's yeah, I don't know if there are any misconceptions. I don't know if people are like, you know,
I don't think anyone thinks
everything
it's
is just
easy.
really hard.
I think
No.
that's, you know, I don't think anyone thinks it's easy. Yeah, Dolly, what are you thinking?
I just want to add that it's not necessarily a misconception, but maybe a misdirection of energies. I'll say this with the caveat that I know everyone has the best intentions, and this is not a criticism. It's more a, you know, it's just to help people understand maybe a little bit. I've seen that there's like a huge increase in people coming to Israel to support and to volunteer and to be part of what's going on here. And it's so beautiful and so appreciated. But there's one little piece that I think needs to be said. And that is if you're coming to Israel, don't forget about the people that you know personally and don't underestimate how much your visit can help them. And it's no less helpful to come and sit on my couch and have a cup of coffee with me than I think it is to go and go to a hospital and visit a stranger. The people who are coming from outside of Israel are bringing a breath of fresh air that we need so badly on an emotional level. And it's not about the gifts, and it's not about the, you know, the financial support. While all that is helpful and critical, I've heard of so many people who've come to Israel on these missions who spend every waking hour doing countless amounts of chesed, but they forgot to spend time with their sister who's been living here alone for 4 months. And so I just think, like, put a little bit into perspective.
Honestly, what you said was on point, really. The whole idea of, like, people coming and volunteering. Chazak, Bemet, like, you guys are incredible for coming to Israel, not to go on vacation or go to the beach or go hang out, you know, like at the bars or the clubs or whatever it is. It's really, like, for people to come in and help out is incredible. What I will also say is, like, just reaching out to your friends. Yafi was my rock when she was in Yerushalayim, when things got really rough, and, like, I haven't spoken to my husband, or my husband was even home, and I was like, listen, I need to just take a minute and not be in my house where I have a million chores to do. I would go to Yafi's house. And to be able to just talk to another person and really just have social interaction.
Yeah, I can hear how that would be, like, important, right? Like, almost vital. What are the things that people have done that have been legitimately helpful? Because, like, I think we've all thought of, like, and I personally have set money for, like, supper and cleaning help and things like that for Army Wives. I would like to think that things like that are helpful, but, like, what are the things that have been above and beyond, oh my God, this really made a difference in my life when people tried to help? You go first, Yafi.
So I want to answer that with also just, like, piggybacking off and saying that everything is helpful, because at the end of the day, like, feeling supported by all of Am Yisrael is huge. Like, I can't count the amount of times since the 7th where I got something that was, like, sent or paid for by somebody outside of Israel who was just like, we were thinking about you, we were thinking about, like, whoever, and, like, it's, like, beyond touching. Also, like, none of us are perfect people. This isn't like a specific, like, outside of Israel thing. Like, I remember in, like, the first month, like, after the 7th, like, Nadav came home at one point, and he was like, wow, he's like, I really need water. Like, do we have water? And I was like, yeah, like, here, drink water. And he's like, yeah, if you don't understand. He's like, the last 2 weeks, he's like, there's no water on base. Like, we can't find water bottles anywhere. There's just bottles filled with Coke and candy everywhere. And my husband is not a health nut. Like, not even close. Like, he, like, will sit down and have his, like, sour candies with his cup of Coke, and then, like, wash it all down with, like, a slice of cake or something. Like, he, like, sugar on sugar on sugar. And he was like, I can't look at Coke anymore. Like, people just keep sending us, like, sweet treats and drinks. So, like, a lot of it is just that, like, we want to help. Like, everyone wants to help. Like, I want to help my friends want to help me. Like, you know, like, we're all trying to do our best. But having said that, like, yes, we all do miss the mark sometimes. And I think that, like, something that has been very helpful is something like what you just mentioned. Like, people, I know people, like, somebody right now, like, a friend of mine is visiting from America, and the community that she lives in raised money for Miluim families. And she came to Israel. And once she got to Israel, you could do it from outside of Israel too, but she basically bought a bunch of Wolt is like Uber Eats, Wolt gift cards, and she sent them to a bunch of Miluim families. Like, that's super helpful. Like, it's helpful, A, because now I know that, like, financially, there have been big stresses on many, if not most of us in this country since the war. So, like, financially, it's helping me. It's helping me mentally, because I know that, okay, if tomorrow night when my child has a fever who woke up screaming in the middle of the night last night, like, if I can't deal with dinner, like, I can just order dinner, and, like, that takes a load off of me. And then if my child, Baruch Hashem, is magically feeling better, and I just want to treat myself so that I can, like, breathe at night, like, there's that. And then there's the added layer of, like, you're supporting the Israeli economy by doing that. You know, like it's money being spent in Israel, even if it came from outside of Israel. And I think like when people do things like that, they're hugely helpful. Like donating money for Miluim families, donating for cleaning help, like you said. Like the first time I had a cleaner, I've never had a cleaner in my life from age 0 to now, almost 30, never had a cleaner. And I had a cleaner come when I had like a really hard time. And it was so meaningful, so incredible. Anything is helpful, just some things I think are less, miss the mark a bit. Like we've had people like buy things from America that could have been bought here that I'm not a business owner. Like it doesn't affect me directly, but like I know many people are, and like it could have been bought here in Israel, and then like that business owner would have been not in a place position where he now has to close the store because his workers are gone and nobody's buying things because everyone here doesn't have enough money right now. So I would say things like that.
Yeah, that seems to make a lot of sense to me. Thanks so much for listening. Part 2 of our conversation is coming at you next week. If you'd like to learn more about Yafi or Tali, you can see their information in the show notes. On last week's episode, we revisited kidney donation with Aviva Burrito, who shared her experience because my brother-in-law is currently looking for a match. So listen to it and learn more about that whole situation wherever you're hearing this episode. The Be Impactful podcast is a project of Impact Fashion, the clothing line I created because I believe that we are all deserving of the beautiful things life has to offer. See my modest designs that are available in sizes 2 through 28 by going to impactfashionnyc.com. Access all of that by swiping up on the cover art. There are currently 17 people listed by Ora Agunot as recalcitrant party. View their names, photos, locations, and details of their cases by visiting getora.org/recalcitrant-parties. The episode art was designed by Michelle Moses, original music composed by Nissan Fetman. This episode was produced and hosted by me, Rifki Itzkowitz. Catch me on all the socials at impact.fashion.nyc. You've spent quite a bit of time listening to me, and now it's my turn to listen to you. By just answering a few questions in a short listener survey, you can share feedback about show content you'd like to see in the future and help me shape Be Impactful into the best showcase of female voices out there. Even better, once you've completed the survey, you'll receive an exclusive code to shop at impactfashionnyc.com as my thanks. The survey is short and sweet and will help me keep bringing you content you love. Just go to impactfashionnyc.com/survey. Again, that's impactfashionnyc.com/survey, and thank you so much in advance.